A new year, a slightly new Congress, and a very much new president. If you thought 2016 was unpredictable, hold on to your hats for 2017 on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. We're just weeks away from the inauguration, and even sooner for the beginning of Senate confirmation hearings for the Trump cabinet.
There is a whole raft of climate deniers who are going to be in charge of environment and energy policy. So it remains to be seen whether any Republicans will come up to challenge their views.
Plus, Bob Schieffer discusses his experience preparing for and moderating three presidential debates.
I had a dream that I had asked all my questions and looked up, and there were still 20 minutes to go. I woke up in a cold sweat, and I swore I would never not have enough questions.
And how do you reconcile Donald Trump's personal life with his appeal among evangelical voters?
Somebody described it as losing all your money in the casino, but you got $2 left, and you don't just walk out the door. You make one last bet for everything on the table, because you feel like you're at that stage in the country.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us. Happy New Year, and welcome to episode 160 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. There's always hope that the two warring parties will put aside some of their rancor and venom as a new year and a new Congress begins. Well, lots of luck with that. Certainly don't look for any olive branch from the Democrats. Whether they have a chance of defeating a cabinet nominee or not, Senate Dems go into 2017 furious about what the Republicans did to Obama court nominee Merrick Garland and are hoping to exact some amount of revenge. Jesse Dolemore of the left-wing Occupy Democrats Report is pleading with Democrats to stand tough.
These are not just terrible appointments. Not only are they unqualified, willfully ignorant, and woefully unprepared for the job, they are also people who have spent their entire adult lives dismantling and railing against the very same government that they now seek to take charge of. So listen up, Senate Democrats. Now is the time to stand strong and give Donald Trump the same respect that he and members of the Republican Party have given President Obama and his appointments.
Good luck with that, said Newt Gingrich on Fox and Friends.
You now have a propaganda media which has no relationship to the news. It's allied with a Washington establishment which is corrupt and dishonest.
Right.
And they are in a state of total shock and denial because the American people chose the person that the establishment hates and fears.
Right.
And so they're going through this process of crazy behavior. But I think Trump's doing the right thing. Focus on building a great cabinet. Focus on setting a great direction.
Right.
Keep talking about making America great again. We'll let the nutcakes over here gripe and groan, and we'll focus on trying to make America great again, and we'll see which appeals to the American people.
The bad feelings are not limited to Congress. It's clear with the American abstention at the UN, which allowed for a vote by the Security Council to condemn Israel's settlement policy, President Obama will leave office still on bad terms with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. But Bibi will have a friend in the new president. And liberals are talking about the end of democracy in North Carolina. This comes in the aftermath of the Republican legislature's decision to curtail the powers of the incoming Democratic governor and its decision to not repeal the controversial HB 2 bathroom bill, which Democrats say was a GOP double-cross. Governor-elect Roy Cooper was furious.
Republican legislative leaders have broken their word to me, and they have broken their trust with the people of North Carolina.
We'll be watching those feuds as the new year goes on. Meanwhile, the first big election of 2017 will be for the chairmanship of the Democratic National Committee. Leaked documents cost both Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her interim successor, Donna Brazile, their jobs. Tom Perez, the outgoing Secretary of Labor, has thrown his hat into the ring for the new DNC chair. Three other Democrats are seeking the post as well. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last person to chair the Democratic National Committee who in his or her career also served in the cabinet? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of the last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Don't stop the party!
If 2016 taught us anything, it's that we should not be in the business of making predictions. Everything we said about Donald Trump proved wrong. Oh, the Democrats would retake the Senate? Wrong. It's probably a smart thing that we go into 2017 without sharing what we think may or may not happen, because it's most likely to be wrong. Still, that doesn't keep us from talking about the kind of year 2016 was and how the early goings of 2017 are shaping up. Neil Conan, the former host of Talk of the Nation, joins us for his regular monthly appearance on The Political Junkie. Neil, welcome back, and I hope you had a great New Year's.
And happy 2017 to you, Ken.
Thank you so much. And somebody who had a great 2016 is Donald Trump. Did you ever in your life?
That laugh will tell you, no, I didn't. I didn't think he would win the Republican nomination. I did not think he had a prayer in the general election. And boy, was I wrong.
With all the postmortems, I mean, I still can't let go of 2016 yet, even though there's so much to talk about 2017. I still can't let go of last year yet. But to this day, the Bernie Sanders people still insist that he would have been the stronger candidate. Do you agree with that?
I don't. I think Bernie Sanders would have been extremely vulnerable in a general election campaign where his identification as a socialist would have been used against him. I think he would not have been as adept as in organizing the party in the same way that Hillary Clinton was. So, yes, I think he would have gotten a lot of young people out to vote, but I don't think he would have gotten the minority vote that Hillary Clinton managed to mobilize. I don't think he would have done as well as she did.
But of course, at the same time, he wouldn't have had a James Comey problem, or he wouldn't have.
No. Let's look back, you know, besides, you know, the obvious biggest loser and biggest winner of 2016. Do you have any other people that you would nominate as the biggest winner and biggest loser in politics for 2016?
That's a great question. I mean, obviously, Trump's the winner and Hillary's the loser. Hillary Clinton's the loser. I don't know if I would classify him a winner or a loser, although certainly by dying, that doesn't make him a winner. But Antonin Scalia, to me, is one of the top two, I think, biggest political stories of the year. And most of it, of course, came after his unforeseen death.
Absolutely. And that, of course, led to the nomination of Merrick Garland, which went absolutely nowhere. And that leads to the man I would nominate as the political winner, other than Donald Trump, of 2016. And that's Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who in his most important and, I guess, last act of obstructionism in the United States Senate, blocked the nomination of Merrick Garland, held it open, he said, for the next president. And I think much to Mitch McConnell's surprise, that next president is Donald Trump.
I remember, I mean, again, I really spend most of my time not making judgment calls, or at least trying to see both sides of things. I mean, sometimes when something is so outlandish, then I just can't help it. But I really thought the Republican strategy of just blocking, you know, just refusing any kind of consideration of the Merrick Garland nomination was a mistake. Even when you think of Robert Bork in 1987, as much as Democrats detested him, they still had hearings, they still had a vote, and he was voted down, but Garland didn't get any of that.
And that's just one of the unprecedented things we saw in 2016. Who would you nominate, again, other than the obvious candidate, that would be Hillary Clinton, as the biggest loser of 2016?
Well, I would say certainly, I mean, Debbie Wasserman Schultz has to be on that list. When those WikiLeaks came out, you know, the hacked conversations, emails that showed that she and the Democratic Party were doing what we always thought what they were doing is rooting for Hillary Clinton. So I don't think, obviously, she didn't have a good year. I think that the head of the Democratic Senatorial Committee didn't have a good year when a lot of people thought the Democrats were going to take back the Senate.
And maybe another political loser of 2016. How about Chris Christie, the first major Republican to come out in support of Donald Trump and leaves with no appointments in the new Trump administration and among the lowest ratings of any New Jersey governor in history?
I know there was a poll that came out this week showing him with 18% approval. And the fact is that once upon a time, he was the, I love this word, the front runner, or at least the Republican who was thought to be the strongest candidate against Hillary Rodham Clinton. And not only did he not go anywhere for that race, as you point out, he endorses Donald Trump and stands there on stage that was mocked ferociously by everybody watching him stand there on stage and then going home empty-handed. And plus the fact that, this year there will be two gubernatorial races, but as governor, he can't run for a third term in 2017.
I don't think his odds would be terrific even if he did, no. It's interesting. As you go back over the list, you mentioned, obviously, Antonin Scalia, who left a gigantic hole on the United States Supreme Court that is now going to be filled in this coming year. Of those other people who are leaving the scene in terms of retirement from politics this year, who are you going to miss the most, Ken? I would give honorable mention to the departures to the Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada. But the guy I'm going to miss the most, Ken, I'd have to say, Charlie Rangel.
Well, you know, I like that you said that because there are things about Charlie Rangel and Harry Reid that were admirable and positive, but there were things that just drove me nuts about the two of them. The fact that, you know, we talk about fake news. Harry Reid had a history of coming up with things that may not have been exactly true, like in 2012 when he said, well, it's my understanding that Mitt Romney has never paid his taxes. And of course, that wasn't true. And when it came out years later that he was making it up, he said, so it worked, didn't it? And that's not my kind of politics. So fake news I've seen on both sides of the aisle. But Charlie Rangel, I mean, he's been in since 1970 when he beat Adam Clayton Powell, who was named after that boulevard in Harlem. But, I mean, he's been in Congress all these years, a remarkable career. But, of course, he was he censured? I think he was censured by the House for some kind of financial transactions. Before we get rid of 2016, you know, we talk about person of the year and man of the year and this of the year. I also have my favorite quote of the year. I want to play it now.
What would you do if you were elected about Aleppo?
About?
Aleppo.
And what is Aleppo?
You're kidding.
No.
Now, I mean, it sounds like I'm making fun of Gary Johnson, the Libertarian Party candidate who said that. But I think the quote, what is Aleppo, says something about the last 8 years of the Obama foreign policy. Now, you and I differ, I think, at least a little bit. I mean, I'm not sure what Obama could have done in Aleppo and Syria and things like that. But the way I see it is that nothing was done and tens of thousands, if not more, were slaughtered.
Absolutely. It has to be regarded as the signal failure of foreign policy in the Obama administration. And it's just played out in the last weeks of 2016 and, you know, horrifying images of the refugees leaving the last enclaves of Aleppo and the artillery attacks by the Syrian army that looked like little more than vengeance at this point. And of course, the bombing raids by, among others, the Russians, who come out of this looking like effective power players in the Middle East, which they certainly did not look like when Barack Obama took office, and in no small part due to the events in and around Aleppo, which also were a big boost to Iran. So we're going to have to see how this all plays out.
Is there any cabinet nominee in danger? I mean, obviously, there's going to be a huge number voting against Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State.
And that's the obvious one. There's going to be questions about him from a lot of Republicans, so he's going to have to answer questions on his support for Russia from, you know, John McCain and Lindsey Graham and Rand Paul is going to have questions for him about that, as well as, of course...
Right, Marco Rubio is also questioning, right?
Absolutely. So it remains to be seen. That's certainly not going to sail through easily. There is a whole raft of climate deniers who are going to be in charge of environment and energy policy. So it remains to be seen whether any Republicans will come up to challenge their views on, you know, what everybody regards as settled science, everybody, of course, but the president-elect and most of the Republican Party.
I think of what happened when President Obama was assembling his first cabinet in end of 2008, beginning of 2009, and he nominated Tom Daschle for, I believe, HHS secretary, who withdrew his name because he didn't reveal his expense account with rental cars. It was such, when you think of all the conflicts, the alleged conflicts of interest that face the current batch of cabinet nominees, let alone the president-elect of the United States, the thought of Tom Daschle pulling his name from consideration in 2009 because of a little tax, I'm not saying a little tax problem, but those previous kind of things that hurt nominees in the past, they don't seem to be affecting this current round of nominees.
No, the bar has been lowered because there's so much and conflict of interest is going to be redefined. I think you're right about that as we move ahead. And, you know, again, you know, I guess we'll have time to look back on the Obama presidency one more time as we reconvene later this year. But, you know, there's going to be such a different tone in Washington, D.C., and again, you can criticize Barack Obama's policies all you want, but there has never been a scandal in the White House during his term of office. He has conducted his presidency with enormous dignity and style, and I think we're just a tweet away from changing all of that.
What do you think the role of the Democratic Party is going to be in the new year?
I think the Democratic Party is going to be torn between areas where it wants to cooperate on, for example, infrastructure spending. And Chuck Schumer has already, the new minority leader in the United States Senate, has already indicated he may well want to cooperate on that. And obstructionism. They will take lessons from what Mitch McConnell accomplished. Of course, Mitch McConnell had a majority in the Senate for most of that time. So the Democrats are in an awkward position.
How much bad feelings still remain about the treatment of Merrick Garland, and how much of a calculation did that play in how the Democrats vote on the Trump cabinet choices, do you think?
As you pointed out, Ken, it's not just Merrick Garland. It was Mitch McConnell who said it was his job to make sure that Barack Obama was a one-term president and to do everything he could to make that happen. Well, that did not work out for him, but he obstructed President Obama every step of the way for 8 years, and that obstructionism, that's going to come, you know, what goes around comes around. I think Democrats will remain extremely angry. Of course, they also changed the filibuster rules in the United States Senate.
Democrats did.
Yeah, a majority vote for most appointments. I think that's going to come around to bite them.
Well, I mean, what about the Republican argument that says what Mitch McConnell did is just a response to what the Democrats did to George W. Bush during his 8 years in office?
It was not comparable, Ken, and you know it. Go back and look at the record.
I think it gets worse and worse, but I mean, it just didn't start. The obstructionism didn't just start in 2009.
No, but there's a level of never, ever anything, and we're going to block you on some things.
Right. What do you think about the role of the media? I mean, it's been so overanalyzed what the media did right and did wrong in 2016, the rise of Donald Trump, of course, and what role the media played in that. But you have a president who feels that he can avoid the media by going straight to the people with his fireside tweets. And I mean, and basically these, what we know about Donald Trump is through all these tweets. What role is left for the media to play, and who cares what the media have to say anymore?
Well, you know, that works as long as you're riding high. When you start to get into trouble, maybe the president will find himself in need of directly communicating with the media. Who knows? Might even hold a news conference.
I started off this conversation, Neil, by saying we're not going to make any predictions, but any predictions for 2017?
I think almost all of Donald Trump's nominations to his cabinet will get through. Rex Tillerson, we'll have to see about that. But I think he will get through as well. I think he will come up with answers that will satisfy Senators McCain and Graham and Rubio and, well, maybe not Rand Paul, but at least those three. So I think he will get through. And what I'm most curious to see in the immediate future of the first part of the Trump administration, who his Supreme Court nominee is going to be.
I don't know if Tillerson goes down. Obviously, I think the highest number of votes will be against him. I don't know who the Supreme Court will be a nominee would be to succeed Antonin Scalia. That's a good point, too. And again, I don't know what's going to happen with the Democratic Party. They vote in February for the next chair. You have Tom Perez, the outgoing Labor Secretary, and Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minnesota. Two different wings of the Democratic Party. Obviously, for the Democratic Party to be a force against Trumpism, they have to unite, and they're not doing much of a job of that, too. So
you said United Democratic Party. There's, you know, going back historically, that's never played out that way. And, you know, I think you're going to see, you know, divisions within the Democratic Party, certainly, but maybe not as many divisions as there are in the Republican Party. Those were exposed during the primaries and the general election campaign. I don't think those are going away.
It'll be interesting to watch what happens with that dynamic. Also, what happens with Vice President Pence. He was kind of a non-factor during the election. He seemed to be much more of a factor dealing with Republicans on Capitol Hill since the election. It'll be interesting to see what kind of a role he has.
And the one thing that we can be confident about saying, Ken, is, well, you know, every week we got to listen to the Political Junkie.
And that's why we have Neil Conan on the first week of every month. Neil Conan is an analyst with Hawaii Public Radio. Neil, once again, Happy New Year, and I'll see you after the inauguration.
Happy New Year, Ken.
We passed up on the stairs. We spoke of what's and when. Although I wasn't there, he said I was his friend. Which came as some surprise. I spoke into his eyes. I thought you died alone a long, long time ago. I know.
I think we can all agree that, as we saw last year during the primaries and the general election, debates can sometimes turn into food fights. Perhaps the solution is to have a moderator who can keep the event civil and who's respected by the way he or she treats the candidates. Bob Schieffer has that reputation, and he was on The Political Junkie last fall. The former longtime chief Washington correspondent for CBS News and host of Face the Nation, Bob was the sole moderator for three presidential debates: Bush and Kerry in 2004, Obama and McCain in 2008, and Obama and Romney in 2012. And to top off his career, he's on The Political Junkie in 2016. Bob, it's wonderful having you on the program.
This is clearly the highlight.
Well,
how are you, Ken? Great to be with you.
We'll see after the show if it's the highlight. Tell me, what kind of a role do you think a debate moderator should play?
The debate moderator should take as his mission to give people as complete a picture as he possibly can of the two people who are running for president. Debates, presidential debates, in my mind anyway, are not gotcha contests. They're a little different than the standard interview. You just want to tell people and help people understand who these people are. And the most important thing that the moderator can remember, I think, is that we're not electing a moderator. We're electing a president of the United States. And I think if you kind of take that as your guiding philosophy, I think you'll get closer to performing a real service for the American people.
But we did see in some of the primary debates where I think the moderator let the back and forth get out of control, and it became, like I said, a food fight.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think especially when you go back to those early Republican debates where you had, 16 candidates out there on the stage at one time, there's no way that you're going to get into any deep understanding of what the issues are. They're more like a attention grabbers, where every candidate is just trying to, you know, grab attention for himself. And I mean, I don't mean that's bad. I mean, you've got to find some way to sort of let people know who you are and set yourself apart. But what happens, they kind of devolve into sort of a grown-up version of the third grade. You know, me, call on me, teacher, I know the answer. And that's not entirely helpful, although it does give people a certain picture of who the candidates are. But it's very, very difficult, I think, with that many people on the stage at one time to have a really serious discussion.
I remember in 1992, Hal Bruno, who was my late boss at ABC News, moderated the Quayle Gore vice presidential debate. And even with two candidates, I mean, the two of them just were talking over each other, and it just became just almost incomprehensible.
That's going to happen. I mean, but again, I mean, that kind of gives you a picture of who the people are, doesn't it? I mean, and I think it speaks well maybe of Hal Bruno that I hadn't remembered that he was the one who was the moderator. Maybe he was letting the two candidates give people a picture of who they were. I tell you one other thing, Ken. I think, and I really appreciate that CNN and the other cables gave so much time to these debates. The networks were there too, because, you know, you really are giving people an opportunity and exposing these people. One of the things that I find troubling in these pre-presidential debates, before we get to the presidential debates, is kind of the atmosphere sometime where you have these large audiences, where you have each candidate is given a certain number of tickets, people cheer and so forth, like you would at a heavyweight championship fight.
Or the Coliseum, right, with gladiators.
Yeah. You know, no wild animals. But I think it really kind of does take away from the seriousness of these things. And, you know, one of the things that I liked about presidential debates is you do have an audience there, and they are each candidate gets a certain number of tickets that their people can be there. But one of the first things that the moderator does when he comes out on the stage is to say, You have all given a pledge of silence. You have all agreed not to give any kind of a demonstration, applaud, or anything of that nature. I always remember Jim Leary used to say, we'll be quiet as little mice out there in the audience. And, you know, it works. I mean, it never fails. Somebody is going to say something is going to make people laugh, and that's fine. But the idea that you don't applaud, you don't demonstrate after either answer, I think really, really helps the situation.
Well, you moderated the final presidential debates in 2004, 2008, 2012. What did you do? How did you prepare for these debates? I mean, it must have been grueling.
If I do say so, I really worked at it. And about 6 weeks before the debates, in 2012, for example, I went around and talked to people at all the think tanks in Washington. Now, you know, every moderator, you go to your organization and you say, hey, guys, you ask all your colleagues, please send me questions. What do you think I ought to ask and all of that? You never tell people what the questions are in advance. You tell no one, because news like that gets out fast and you don't want to give either candidate an advantage. But what I would do is I called up the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I would call over there and say, who's your expert on cyber? Who's your expert on the Middle East? And then I would ask those people if I could come and talk to them. And it was very interesting. You know, their experts love to talk about their expertise because no one ever asks them. And so when I would call these people, they would say, well, you don't need to come over here. I'll come over to your office. And I did. In that 6 weeks before the final debate, I talked to 26 people at think tanks. And when I say I talked to them, they would come to my office and we would chat for an hour and a half, 2 hours. And I would form questions out of that. And the bottom line was, by the time that debate came along, I had probably 300 questions in a notebook. Now, I think as the debate unfolded, I probably used 12 or 13 of those questions because so many of the questions you'll ask during the debate are follow-ups. But I had a dream before I did the first debate that that I had asked all my questions and looked up, and there were still 20 minutes to go. And I woke up in a cold sweat, and I swore I would never not have enough questions. So I always go into those, always went into them with more questions than I could ever possibly need. But it does really help you, you know, get yourself up to speed on all the issues that you're going to be talking about.
You know, we all know that when we watch these debates, we respond not only to what the candidates say, but, you know, the famous George H.W. Bush looking at his watch or Al Gore sighing, things like that. Was there anything you noticed or you came away with in any of those debates that really surprised you and something, you know, that just really hit home for you?
I'll tell you two things. Number one, the thing that really surprised me in the 2012 debate is Benghazi was a big issue, as you recall, still is. And so I thought, well, to really get this thing off to a good start, I will just pose a question about Benghazi. They flipped a coin, and the question went to Mitt Romney. And I asked it, and I mean, this was not a hard question. It was just a big old fastball right down the center of the plate. And I figured whoever I asked that question of was going to give it a good, sharp answer, and the other guy was going to come back with a totally different point of view. And it turned out to be Romney, and to my surprise, he sort of deflected the question. And I could not figure out why he would do that. And Obama came back with a really strong answer. I found out later that the Romney people went into that debate thinking that Romney was ahead. And they sort of went into a prevent defense, which was a mistake. They weren't ahead, and they really passed up an opportunity there, I thought. And that was kind of carried through throughout the debate. The second thing, and I'm not sure what this had to do with anything, but one of the more surprising things I noticed during the debate between Obama and John McCain is when Obama would speak during that debate, McCain would furiously take notes, and John McCain being John McCain, and I have to admit, I think the world of the guy, you know, he was squirming around in his chair and was over-caffeinated, or seemed to be like he always does, and has always been throughout his career, and he would take these notes, and then when McCain would speak, Obama never took a note. He just stared at him like a prize fighter would, you know, before the fight. He just had this stare. And he had a notebook. He didn't take a single note, but he had a pen in his hand, and he would just draw this straight line across the notebook. Now, I don't know if that was some sort of a Zen meditation device. I don't know. I don't know what it was, but that's what he did. But they were just so totally different. Now, that debate, and I think it's the best possible format you can have, they were both seated at the same table with me. And I think that is the best way to do it. I think, you know, when you sit them down where they're close enough, they can touch one another, and yet they're not up walking around like Al Gore did during that debate, one of the ones that you referred to. I think it gives a totally different and more business-like atmosphere.
We've been obviously talking about the changes of debates, you know, since they began with Kennedy and Nixon. One, the thought of a live audience during Kennedy and Nixon and people hooting and hollering, just, you know, it seems so incongruous to think of, you know, back in the day. But is it because we're old timers or something? But we always talk about the way things used to be when it comes to, you know, politics or conventions or debates. Are you optimistic about the future of these debates?
Well, you know, number one, I think things are always kind of get romanticized when you're looking in the rearview mirror. And sometimes they may appear a little better than they were, but I think our politics is degenerating. I don't think the whole political system is operating quite as well as it used to. I mean, you have a Congress that is in eternal gridlock, it seems like. I think what's happened this time is kind of the center of our political electoral system is sort of imploded. Think about this. I mean, we know what happened on the Republican side, and yet on the Democratic side, you had basically one legitimate Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton. Her main opposition came from someone who proudly said he was not a Democrat. At one point said he was not a capitalist. I mean, I've never heard of any candidate running for anything in America who would feel compelled to make that kind of a statement. I think there's great disappointment among the general public right now about how this campaign wound up and who the two candidates were that were nominated by the major parties. I mean, here you have two people who are both widely distrusted by a majority of the American people and, furthermore, not particularly well-liked. I don't think our political system is operating very well right now.
Bob, thank you for that optimistic forecast.
Yeah.
Bob Schieffer is the former host of Face the Nation and the longtime CBS News correspondent. He moderated the final presidential debates in 2004, 2008, and 2012. Bob, it was an honor and privilege to have you on the program.
Well, thank you so much, Ken, and all the best to you.
Thanks so much.
Good evening from Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. I'm Bob Schieffer of CBS News. I want to welcome you to the third and last of the 2004 debates between President George Bush and Senator John Kerry. The audience behind me has promised to be quiet, except at this moment when we welcome Barack Obama and John McCain. Right now, when we welcome President Barack Obama and Governor Mitt Romney.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, in the wake of Louisiana State Treasurer John Kennedy winning election to the Senate last month, who was the most recent member of Congress who had the same first and last name as a former president? The answer? Well, this sounds like cheating, but it's Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr. Son of the 32nd president, Roosevelt Jr. was elected to Congress from Manhattan in a special 1949 election and served until 1954 when he decided to run for governor of New York. His bid going nowhere, he dropped out and instead was persuaded to run for the state attorney general. But he lost that election to a Republican by the name of Jacob Javits. The randomly selected winner is I.O. Dennis of Denver, Colorado. And now I owe Dennis the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutton winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. In our last contest, the first button read, the new frontier man of the year, astronaut John Glenn. Then came a presidential campaign button for Gary Hart. Another John Glenn astronaut button. And finally, a Perot for President button from 1992. So when you combine Glenn and Gary and Glenn and Ross, you kind of get Glenn Gary Glenn Ross, that David Mamet play that was made into a 1992 movie. Not one of my favorite movies. The winner is Guy Petzl of Ullapool, Scotland. As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, scuttlebutton puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store. Go to krpoliticaljunkie.com. If there was ever a presidential cycle in recent years with a clear, overwhelming Republican frontrunner, it was 2000. George W. Bush, the two-term governor of Texas and the son of a former president, was the odds-on favorite for the nomination. He had the endorsements, the money, the organization, everything. Still, that didn't prevent other Republicans from getting into the race. One of them was Gary Bauer, who left his job as president of the Family Research Council, a conservative organization that called itself pro-family and pro-life, to run. His was an unambiguous platform of opposition to abortion and in support of what was considered traditional marriage. He appealed to Iowa's evangelical voters. Here he is in April of 1999.
I believe America can be a special place, a city on a hill, a shining city on a hill, where our schools are safe, where virtue counts, a country where motherhood and fatherhood is revered as much as any career, where criminals are behind bars, not law-abiding, decent American families. These are the things I am about. These are the values that I think are important. This is the good fight I am ready to wage with all my heart and soul. That is why I am proud to stand here today in Newport, Kentucky, and to ask you to stand with me, to give me your strength and your support as I announce my candidacy for the Republican nomination to be the next president of the United States.
But his campaign never caught on. He got 8.5% of the vote in the 2000 Iowa caucuses, a fourth-place finish, but fared much worse in the New Hampshire primary, a fifth-place finish with just 1% of the vote. And he ended his campaign.
I do that feeling good about the effort that has been made, good about how I have moved the debate in this party, and good about the American people that I have met in every state that I have traveled to.
We had Gary Bauer on the program as the 2016 campaign was getting started, not so much to dwell on his failed presidential bid, but to reflect on the role of evangelicals in the Republican Party. Gary Bauer, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Great to be with you, Ken. You brought a tear to my eyes there with as I was listening to myself. I'd still vote for that guy.
And in 2000, you actually had a wide selection of candidates in addition to Bush. You had Steve Forbes and his flat tax. You had the maverick John McCain. You had Alan Keyes. I don't even know how to describe Alan Keyes, but what's your memory of that field, and what gave you hope?
Well, it was interesting as a Reagan conservative, which is how I define myself. I worked for President Reagan for 8 years, that all of the candidates, even the ones that would be considered the establishment candidates, like George W. Bush or, in his own way, Steve Forbes, all of them tried to present themselves as Reagan conservatives. So it was interesting to see that. And in its own way, it was encouraging to realize that Reagan had moved the party in a direction that everybody wanted to emulate and be part of. Look, I'm the son of a janitor. It was an incredible experience. I recall being in one of the first presidential debates and standing on the stage before the debate would begin and looking down to my right at the other podiums and seeing the son of a general, a son of a billionaire, a son of a former president, and Spike Bauer's son. So, you know, it's a great country where people from average backgrounds can compete in this contest.
When you kept saying son of a, I was afraid you were going to say something nasty.
I was heading there, but I stopped myself before it was too late.
So what was your strategy in 2000, given all the other candidates who were running?
Well, look, I'm a conservative, but I'm not delusional. I mean, I didn't actually think at the end of the day I was going to get the nomination, but I wanted to move the party back, not just rhetorically to these conservative ideas, but move it to embrace the three-legged stool that Reagan popularized, smaller government, lower taxes being one leg, a strong national defense being one, and then the third, traditional values, the sanctity of life, and so forth. And so I spent a lot of time on that. Ken, you do a lot of this kind of research and so forth. I don't know if you came across it. I also went after Bush on the China issue, and I feel quite proud about that because then Governor Bush was promoting the idea of China trade and that it would change China. And I argued that it was much more likely to change America, that we would become less likely to be concerned about or to raise human rights issues in China if we had a whole bunch of people making money there. And I think time has proven me right on that.
When you think of candidates with strong ties to evangelical Christians, Pat Robertson in 1988, you in 2000, Mike Huckabee in 2008, they have good showings in Iowa, but then what?
In the case of Pat Robertson, I don't think he had any appeal beyond evangelical voters. And the other candidates, they didn't have money. And you know, you could do very well in Iowa doing a grassroots campaign. But when you leave Iowa, you've got to have millions of dollars in the bank to do the TV advertising that becomes so important as the primaries come up quicker and quicker, and grassroots campaigning won't be enough.
What do you make of Donald Trump? He's had three marriages. His career ideologically has been all over the map. He's had liberal policies and policy positions in the past, and yet he gets endorsed by Jerry Falwell Jr. How do you explain that?
Well, I think it goes without saying that that endorsement raised some eyebrows. But I find among the people that support my work that there's a significant percentage of them that are tempted by Trump. And I think the reason is that there's this incredible angst around the country, particularly among working class people or middle America, if you will. I don't think we fully understand it if you live on the East Coast or in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., or on the West Coast, but there's a very pronounced sense that the country's off the tracks, that our best days are over, that it's not possible anymore for our children to have a better life than we did. Trump hits a lot of nerves when he talks about putting America first again, talking about how often we are on the short end of the stick in international negotiations. And I think there's a whole range of things happening economically, culturally, and otherwise that lead to that willingness by somebody like Jerry Falwell Jr. or some other surprising people and to say, look, I've tried everything else. This guy may not go to the same church I go to or worship the way I go to, but he seems to understand how upset I am and worried I am about where America is. And so somebody described it as losing all your money in the casino, but you got $2 left and you don't just walk out the door. You make one last bet, you know, for everything on the table because you feel like you're at that stage in the country and in our history.
You know, when I think back to that 2000 campaign, I guess I consider you as somewhat of an outsider in 2000, but I don't remember there being a cry for outsider candidates back then like we see today.
I think you're absolutely right. As you can imagine, when I started trying to line up support, even among some who were close friends or headed up conservative groups, they understandably would say to me, well, Gary, you're a great guy, but nobody's been elected president without holding another elected office first, unless they had just liberated Europe, in the case of Eisenhower. And it was a fair argument. This cycle, holding previous office in some ways has almost been a burden, an impediment. And candidates like Dr. Carson and Donald Trump and some others have gotten a great deal of traction. And ironically, another sort of truth, quote unquote, in politics, that governors have an easier time of getting a nomination than senators do. I can think of four governors that would like that to be explained to them again because they're all having trouble getting traction.
A lot of them have already dropped out of the race, right?
Yes, absolutely.
There's a lot of venom, a certain amount of venom in politics today, certainly on the Republican side, and far more than there was in 2000. What do you think accounts for that?
I think it's just a sign of the times. The culture has become somewhat more vulgar. People in our internet society, our social media society, are used to reading and hearing things said that, you know, my mother would have washed my mouth out with soap if I had said in her presence. So, you know, I think there's part of that. If you're talking about the greater anger there is between the left and right in America, I guess I would argue that that goes both ways, and I certainly blame in some ways the tendency on the left in recent years to suggest that if you don't agree with them about a particular big government program, then you, quote, want people to starve, or you're going to push grandma off a cliff, or you don't care about minorities or whatever, instead of actually debating the pros and cons of different policy approaches.
Although, to be fair, there are people on the other side who talk about Latinos and Muslims and women and the handicapped that seem a little over the top.
Well, whoever you're referring to, I'll let him defend himself. But I think most of the rhetoric that I hear from my colleagues and by conservatives generally, it's an inclusive rhetoric. I would hasten to add, however, that I think it's important at a time when you mentioned Muslims just now. I have Muslim friends and acquaintances, and I believe in the freedom of religion. But I think the effort to stop people from discussing the obvious, which is there is a significant problem within Islam that needs to be addressed. I recall a few weeks ago, just a week after the horrible attacks in Paris, at a soccer game in Turkey, between Turkey and Greece, they began the game by calling for a moment of silence, and 30,000 Turks booed for the entire minute. There is a degree of bigotry in the Muslim world, a rejection of our understanding of religious liberty, treatment of women and others that is completely out of the mainstream of what Western society and Judeo-Christian society believes in. And I think to act like that doesn't exist or that it has nothing to do with the horrible things we're seeing around the world is to really engage in a terrible form of deception.
Back home, are you optimistic about the future of the Republican Party?
You'll probably think I'm straining credibility here. I don't go to bed at night worried about the future of the Republican Party. I worry about the future of this great country. I've got grandkids. We want this country to succeed. The world goes into another dark age, in my view, if America doesn't make it. So if the Republican Party comes up and can articulate the right answers to make sure that the American century is this century too, they'll do very well. If they can't, then the real tragedy will not be that the Republican Party will fail, but that America may fail.
Gary Bauer is the president of American Values, an organization that is, quote, committed to defending life and traditional marriage. He's the former president of the Family Research Council, and he sought the Republican Party nomination for president in 2000. Gary Bauer, it was wonderful having you on the program.
Great to be with you, Ken.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.